Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're serving you episode 4 in our series, Amazon the Prime Effect, where we're exploring how the trillion-dollar company is changing how we shop, work, and live. And today, in order to learn more about a specific part of Amazon, we're actually going to start by talking about Netflix.
We recognized that with the advent of streaming, that Netflix computational resources was going to grow rapidly. We didn't really appreciate how rapidly, but very rapidly. And so we started to figure out how to build out our data centers.
That's Netflix CEO Reed Hastings remembering the time back in 2008 when those red DVD envelopes in the mail were about to go the way of the dodo, more or less, because of the rapid growth in streaming technologies. Hastings says that something else was about to go extinct at Netflix, too.
Someone sent me Nicholas Carr's book, The Big Switch. When reading that book, and he pointed out that companies like Netflix used to have a VP of electricity. That was a real role. That was an important role because you generated your own electricity. And that's so absurd by our modern standards. It hit me that, wow, this is really happening. And that's when we started working with AWS.
AWS, Amazon Web Services, the cloud computing service that today hosts the digital content for massive companies like Netflix and Zoom and Slack and thousands of others, big and small. Netflix was an early adopter of Amazon's cloud computing service. Hastings shared this story back in 2012 at reInvent, AWS's biggest event of the year. That same year, Amazon hosted 95% of Netflix's computation and storage needs.
You know, we were ahead of our time, but we were facing some extraordinary growth. So streaming at that point in 2008 was about a million hours a month, and now it's over a billion hours a month. So we've had this thousand-fold ramp up in computational resources necessary over just 4 years.
A billion hours of streaming a month. Back in 2012. By 2016, 100% of Netflix's computation and data storage was on AWS. By 2020, Netflix had about 63.7 million users in the United States, and they watched about 204 million hours of Netflix a day. So that is 6.1 billion hours a month, six times what it was just 8 years earlier. So, all that binge watching you're doing on Netflix, and frankly, a lot of places you visit on the internet in general, all that is happening through Amazon. So let me turn to Tim Bray now. Tim, do you think that it would be at all possible for Netflix to handle that explosive growth in streaming if it had to build its own data centers and manage its own computational needs?
Hi, Meghna. Yeah, it would certainly be possible in principle, but how long would it take and how much would it cost? They would have to, you know, acquire the land, build the data centers, build the racks, arrange the electricity, hire expert people to do security, install. It would be a massive job and would take years, literally, to build that. We know it would take years because it's taken AWS years to build the infrastructure that Netflix is using today. So why would Netflix do that itself when it can, you know, hire buy expert services?
Yeah, so that's what Hastings was talking about, the in companies of the past having a vice president for electricity. No one has that anymore. So seeing the same shift in terms of cloud computing. Now, let me formally introduce you. This is Tim Bray, and from December 2014 to May 2020, he was senior principal technologist, vice president, and distinguished engineer at Amazon Web Services. We'll talk a little bit later about why Tim left the company, but he joins us today from Vancouver, British Columbia. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
So, first of all, I wonder if you could just give us the sort of 101 on what AWS is, because I think it may be one of the most important parts of Amazon that many people don't even know about, even though they're probably using it every single day. So how would you define what AWS is?
Well, every, you know, company or business or government department has an IT department where they take care of your computing needs. And that ranges everything from, you know, giving you a web browser, giving you, you know, access to the internet, to running databases, to running their own proprietary code, to, you know, storing data, to looking things up. And basically, AWS's goal is to provide all of that on a rental basis, so that you don't actually have to own any of the infrastructure. You just, you know, spin it up as you need it from AWS, and AWS makes it available. You know, the electricity analogy is good. If you need to, you know, draw some more electricity, you don't have to build any new switches. You just, you know, turn up the switch, and your electricity supplier makes that electricity available. So AWS is trying to do the same thing with basically every kind of computing service.
Okay. So there's a lot of reasons why AWS is important to what we're understanding cloud computing as it is now and what it might become, but also why it's important to Amazon. And one of those reasons is that the man who was formerly head of Amazon Web Services, Andy Jassy, is going to be the next CEO almost any second now for Amazon writ large. What do you think the significance of that is, Tim?
Yeah, in fact, I think he still is for a few more minutes. So you know, it's easy to understand why they promoted Andy to that job. AWS didn't exist in 2006, and now it's a $50 billion business. I mean, you know, what better credentials could you possibly have to step into a job like that? What does it mean? I think it means that Amazon will go on succeeding because Andy is obviously a highly capable executive and has done a good job. One issue that might be of particular interest to this program is, does it increase the likelihood or decrease it that AWS and Amazon get split up?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll definitely talk about that. But I want to still listen and learn from you a little bit more about the origin story of AWS. Like, where did this idea come for Amazon, which at that time was not known at all as being a massive player in the cloud computing business, and yet it created Amazon Web Services. So let's just listen to Andy Jassy himself for a second on a Harvard Business School podcast talking about the origin of Amazon Web Services.
We had this idea that maybe we could build a technology infrastructure platform that would both allow Amazon to develop and build things more quickly, but also lots of other third-party companies. And so I left that shadow job to go work with a team, what we call a vision document for what a business might look like there. And that's what turned into AWS.
Tim Bray, once again, that was Andy Jassy on a Harvard Business School podcast. And Dori Scheimer, our senior editor, and I kept marveling that the CEO of Amazon Web Services and Harvard Business School could not get together and have a higher quality sound for their podcast. But nevertheless, can you tell us a little bit more about where this idea came from? What necessitated the need for Amazon to say, we're going to enter cloud computing?
Well, you know, Amazon has always been a very opportunistic company and looked for opportunities in, you know, across many sectors of the business space. So in connection with keeping Amazon.com on the air, they'd obviously had to become very, very expert at building out lots of computing infrastructure to support the website. And, you know, computers, running code, storing data, transmitting data, transforming data, doing machine learning, all that stuff had to be built. And, you know, they noticed after a while that they were getting pretty good at building this, and well, maybe they could try selling it. And well, that was what Andy just said. And in fact, they did. And that's AWS.
Okay. So what is it fair to call it a revolutionary idea at the time?
I guess, you know, it's one of those things that's so obvious in the rearview mirror. You know, back in the days when everybody was electrifying their businesses, you know, the notion that, well, in a few decades, you wouldn't have a generator in your basement unless you were a hospital or something like that. You would buy it, you know, over the wire. May have seemed revolutionary, but now it seems so obvious that why would you do it any other way?
But that's always what good ideas are like, right? They seem obvious in retrospect. But how would you describe now the importance of AWS to, you know, everyday people, even if they don't know that they're using it?
Well, just because the internet depends fairly radically these days on AWS, and to be fair, the competition from Google and Microsoft, mm-hmm. that a very high proportion of the things that you interact with on the internet every day are coming from a cloud computing vendor, and the proportion is increasing steadily, and we don't know where the final state is, but my personal belief is that a very, very large majority of all things you access will eventually be cloud computing.
All things.
Yeah.
And so we won't even have like native software on our own machines anymore?
Oh, no. We'll still have computers and phones okay. and iPads and all that stuff. But none of those these days are very useful without the cloud being there, without the internet being there to talk to. And more of the internet is going to migrate onto the cloud, public cloud providers.
So in that sense, then, it's absolutely critical to our digital lives, at least.
Completely.
Okay.
And more so every day.
More so every day. Now, Tim, we have about a minute to go before the first break here. And I wanted to just step back for a moment with you because you were a VP at Amazon Web Services, principal technologist, distinguished engineer from December 2014 to May 2020. So a good 6 years. Had you been working at Amazon before that?
No.
No. Okay. So you came in 2014. What was it like to work at AWS?
It was great. I mean, there are two things that make a computer programmer happy. One is making money, and the other is affecting a lot of people's lives. And we were, you know, really at the cutting edge of the biggest change that's going on in computing these days, which is the migration to the cloud. You know, everything you built and shipped, you could have a high confidence that huge numbers of people would be using it. Millions of transactions would rely on it. The code that I personally helped build was being used millions of times a second. That makes a programmer happy.
And was it a good place to work?
It was a great place to work. They were super fussy about their hiring. The density of difficult people was very low. The relationships with the customers were wonderful. They were doing such fascinating stuff. The business was successful. It was growing fast. If you needed to spend money to accomplish something, you could. It's by wide margin the best job I ever had.
Wow. And yet in May 2020, you left because of the reality of what it's like to work for Amazon for other employees. And we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But today, listeners, it's episode 4 of our series Amazon, The Prime Effect, where we're trying to learn how Amazon is changing everything about what it means to shop, work, and live in the modern world. And today we're focusing on Amazon Web Services, as you heard Tim Bray describe it, one of the most critical services on the internet when it comes to cloud computing that's having an impact on us all. We'll hear a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today it's episode 4 of our ongoing series, Amazon, The Prime Effect, and we are learning all we can today about Amazon Web Services, the massive presence that Amazon has in the rapidly growing world of cloud computing, and how already when you hop onto Netflix or maybe use Slack for work, or if your kids use Zoom for school, those are just three examples of services that exist because their computation needs are being managed by Amazon. I'm joined today by Tim Bray from December 2014 to May 2020, he was senior principal technologist and then vice president and distinguished engineer at AWS. And let's listen to a little bit of the a current member of Amazon, and this is Amazon CTO Werner Vogels. We talked to him a few days ago about the significance, as you heard me mention before, of the fact that the head of AWS, Andy Jassy, is going to become the next CEO of all of Amazon. And here is what Werner Vogels said is the significance of that move.
Well, you know, it's not just that Andy Jassy ran AWS. I mean, he's been at Amazon for 24 years. And as such, he has a very strong hook into the Amazon culture. And so I don't expect that that terribly much change when Andy takes over from Jeff Bezos. And Andy is an is probably one of the most customer-obsessed leaders that I've ever met. And so I believe he's the ideal person to lead the company going forward.
That's Amazon CTO Werner Vogels. We talked to him a few days ago, and we'll hear a little bit more from him later. Now, Tim, I'm wondering if you could tell me what you make of the fact that by some estimates, and it's a little tough to pin down, but by some estimates, AWS right now has about 30% of the cloud computing market. Is that a number to be concerned about, or is it not? Because it looks like cloud computing is just on a huge growth path.
Well, I think the number may actually be higher than that, and it's really hard to discover how big the cloud computing market actually is, because, you know, what's cloud computing? Is you know, Outlook email cloud computing? Is, you know, Google Maps cloud computing? And then there are other vendors such as Oracle and IBM who are trying to get into cloud computing and making large inflated claims about, you know, how much revenue they really have. But it's pretty clear that AWS is the biggest chunk. It could be as high as 50%, but 30% sounds plausible to me. Perhaps the thing to be worried about is that in terms of real credible vendors, there are only three, which is AWS, Microsoft, Azure, and Google Cloud Platform. And three is a little bit small to have a healthy, thriving marketplace. And it's not clear we're going to get that many more because it's awfully expensive to get into this business. You're looking at, you know, tens and hundreds of billions of dollars of capital spending to build all those data centers and network infrastructure and so on and so forth. So yeah, there are areas of concern here.
Wow. Okay. So that small handful of companies then, including Amazon, are running a market that's what, more than $1.5 trillion a year now, and only expected to grow. Is that right?
Well, AWS is currently $50 billion a year. That number is clear. So let's assume that 30% number is right. So that means that cloud computing is somewhere between $100 and $200 billion a year, which sounds like a pretty big number. But I was just looking at a Gartner report published late last year. They estimate global IT spend as $3.8 trillion a year. So, you know, cloud may look big, but it's just a little corner of the market at the moment. So it's big, but it has insanely huge growth potential.
Okay. So here, this is the thing that's so interesting to me, because without a doubt, AWS, as it exists and the service that it offers to companies, has allowed remarkable things. It's allowed remarkable growth at scale and very rapidly for companies that, as you mentioned earlier, would otherwise be languishing, spending, you know, vast amounts of money in many years building their own infrastructure, server farms, etc. And here's one kind of amazing example, which I think everyone will, or a lot of people will relate to, that before the pandemic, there was Zoom, which was used by, you know, I don't know how many people, but not anywhere near the number of people that used it almost like overnight once the pandemic hit. So that kind of huge ability to scale up because Amazon Web Service is there is, it seems like an amazing and good thing. But on the other hand, let's talk about some of the additional concerns. When there are so few companies, or just one that you say AWS could have up to 50% of the cloud computing market, should we be concerned about the potential security issues or the robustness of the security infrastructure against outside threats that AWS has in place?
Well, we should definitely be concerned about internet security. You know, the net is full of extremely bad people trying to do bad things. And also, you know, people screw up sometimes and make security goofs. So it's a thing that we should all be concerned about. So does cloud computing make it better or worse? You know, a very wise person once said, well, when you want to guard something closely, you can put your eggs in different baskets or you can put them all in one basket and guard it really, really well. My personal belief is that the use of cloud computing generally, it improves internet security simply because companies like AWS and, once again, the competitors Google and Microsoft can afford to put together these huge elite security groups that, you know, a typical company would just never have a chance to hire that scale and that talent level. So I think that by and large, if you take your existing infrastructure and you move it onto the cloud, you're probably going to come out with a better security story. Doesn't mean internet security problems are going to go away, but I think that the clouds are a force for good in that respect. Mm.
Now, we're going to spend a lot of the rest of the show exploring the question of whether there's too much concentration in the market. And so just take a quick second here, about 30 seconds or so, Tim, and give us your first argument. You've actually written a 6-page narrative. We'll talk about the existence of those in a second, about why you actually think AWS should be broken off from Amazon. Can you give us the top line on that?
Well, the top line is that Amazon is too big and too powerful, just like the other big techs, and they need to be split up. So, you know, just a good civic policy, and I'm sure, you know, Representative Cicilline, who you quoted earlier, could have a lot more to say on that. But, you know, you can make a case in the case of AWS in Amazon's own interest. Right at the moment, AWS has like a 30% profit margin. So if you're a typical business spending, well, say $10 million on computing with AWS, you're sending $3 million of profit off to Amazon, and there's a good chance these days that Amazon is competing with you because Amazon seems to be competing with anybody. So, you know, that actually is a pretty significant headwind, I would think, in AWS's growth. So you can make a pretty strong case that AWS would do better if it were not joined at the hip with Amazon. So I think there are a lot of good reasons to split AWS out, and it's something that I think is very likely to happen.
Okay. So here's one of the reasons why it may be likely to happen, because you're right. I talked to Congressman David Cicilline of Rhode Island, Democrat. He is the chair of the House Subcommittee on Antitrust, Commercial, and Administrative Law. And here's what he had to tell us.
Companies have monopoly power, that they use that power to keep others out of the marketplace, to preference their own goods and services, that disadvantage consumers, that crush small businesses, and that have resulted in a decline in innovation.
So that very House committee that Cicilline chairs just last week passed a package of 6 antitrust bills onto the full House. One gives additional resources to the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission to enforce antitrust laws. Another prevents big tech platforms from favoring their own products, like Amazon Basics and the Amazon Marketplace. Yet another bill would change rules on mergers to prevent big tech companies from acquiring companies to eliminate competition. So taken together, these 6 bills amount to the most significant update to federal antitrust regulation in a generation. So here is what I asked Congressman Cicilline. If these bills get passed, would that necessitate the breakup of a company like Amazon?
Yes. So the legislation that you're referring to is Ending Platform Monopolies Act. And that basically recognizes that certain platforms, if you're a covered platform, and that's determined by the market cap value of the company, the number of monthly users, and whether you're a critical trading partner, Amazon clearly meets all 3 parts of that test. And so they would have to make a choice. You can either be the marketplace, in which you provide an opportunity to sell goods and services and control and write the rules of the marketplace, or you can be a seller of goods and services, but you can't do both. Because what we learned during the course of the investigation is that Amazon favors its own goods and services, and it's collecting all of this information from its sellers. And then they use that to inform the decisions they make to compete directly with those sellers. And consumers don't know that. They think, oh, this appeared in the buy box. This is some objective analysis that this is the best toaster, when in fact it's a product of some business relationship with the seller or Amazon's own product. That's an irreconcilable conflict of interest. You ought not to be able to do both. And so that piece of legislation would require the breakup of Amazon.
But, you know, because we've heard repeatedly from Amazon itself, from the corporation, and in fact, I mean, if we're talking about Amazon Marketplace for a second here, in fact, from a lot of sellers who say that their business wouldn't be possible if it weren't for the reach and the services that Amazon provides. And Amazon itself says if they're guilty of anything, it's of being so customer focused that they're providing the best service for those very customers. So why break up the company when what they're able to provide is great service at scale?
This is a classic argument of a monopolist. Geez, we're doing it big. Just let us continue to do it. And part of that is because Amazon is doing two things at once. It's collecting all of this data that it uses then to inform its decisions it makes to compete directly with those sellers. So nothing would prevent Amazon from continuing to provide all those services to their customers, to be a marketplace. They just can't at the same time be taking that very same information that they're collecting to design and market their own products and promote them in an unfair way. And you would make space for other entrepreneurs and innovators to enter the market to sell those goods and services. So consumers would end up with more choice. And that's why breaking them up is essential if we're serious about restoring competition.
So you are saying that you do think Amazon is a monopoly?
No question.
We're focusing also on Amazon Web Services, which is a fascinating part of this company that just about everyone touches every day if they use the internet, whether they know it or not. Now, in the House report, there was really interesting language around AWS. It said that, quote, Amazon Web Services provides critical infrastructure for many businesses. Can you talk about why that particular language was used?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very similar to what you think in terms of the way we regulate utilities. It's hard to imagine you can conduct business in this country today without the services of Amazon in some way. And so, and be mindful, they are engaged in enormous retrieval and collection of data in every part of this process that puts them at an extreme, gives them an extreme advantage. And so this is just another mechanism to be collecting very useful data from competitors that they then use for the benefit of their own company.
I would think that Amazon would say that for Amazon Web Services, they are not data mining the information that's coming through the client services they host. They might be doing that on Amazon Marketplace, but for AWS, they say that they're absolutely not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I have very difficult time accepting a representation made by Amazon. They lied to our committee during the investigation, and there was then a Wall Street Journal investigation that proved that unequivocally. So, you know, our investigation found all four of these large technology platforms have enormous market dominance. They are using that in a variety of different ways to exclude rivals, to condition entry into their marketplace by using their goods and services, to acquire competitors and crush them. You know, the collection of data exists in all of these platforms. And so they're allowed to do that because of the monopoly power they have and because Congress hasn't prevented them thus far.
A couple of weeks ago, we spoke with litigator David Boies. You know him really well. He actually worked for the Justice Department a long time ago when the Justice Department prosecuted Microsoft. And interestingly, he told us that he believes existing antitrust laws are actually sufficient to regulate these big modern tech companies. The problem is that they're just not being enforced properly. But you seem to think that we need a massive update of antitrust laws. So why do that instead of more rigorous enforcement of what's on the books?
Well, look, I think we have to do both. But the truth is our antitrust laws were written a generation ago and haven't really been updated or modernized to meet the 21st century economy. So there are tools that are available. We've had a number of court decisions that have improperly narrowed antitrust enforcement and really turned it on its head. They've made it much more difficult for antitrust enforcers to do their work. So I think we've got to update and modernize statutes. We have to be sure our antitrust agencies have the resources they need to properly enforce antitrust. And then we have to be sure that those that are leading the antitrust work at the Department of Justice and the FTC are sufficiently enthusiastic and creative about competition policy. I'm excited. We have folks like Tim Wu on the National Economic Council. We have Lina Khan chairing the FTC. These are people who understand what the monopoly power of these large platforms means. But we also need to update our statutes.
But it seems as if Some of the most recent concern about the bills are coming from your fellow Democrats, particularly California lawmakers who are concerned about the economic impact that antitrust actions on these big tech companies would have on their districts. I mean, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, the whole purpose of competition, the reason we have as a country been so determined and insistent on protecting competition is because we all recognize that with competition, you get more innovation, more entrepreneurship, new ideas, more jobs, more companies. And that's the whole idea. And so I recognize there are some people who think this will have some short-term harm to a company in my district. I don't actually think that's true. I think if you talk to people at Microsoft, they would tell you that they are a better company today as a result of the antitrust investigation and action that the federal government undertook. I think what I would say to my colleagues is competition is good for the economy. It's good for companies. It's good for small businesses, entrepreneurs. More competition brings more innovation and more jobs. And the idea of protecting these big, large monopolies as a way to protect jobs is, I think, short-sighted. The best way we can ensure that we continue to grow jobs in this sector and in this country is by restoring competition in the digital marketplace so we can make space for the next great Google or Facebook or Amazon that can compete successfully. But as long as these monopolies exist, they make no room for the next innovator, the next great American company. That's bad for the country. It's bad for our economy. And it's ultimately going to be bad for their district.
Congressman David Cicilline is chair of the House Subcommittee on Antitrust, Commercial, and Administrative Law. He represents Rhode Island's first. Thank you so much, Congressman.
My pleasure. Good being with you.
And we spoke with Congressman Cicilline on Friday of last week. So, Tim Bray, hang on here for just a second. When we come back from the break, I'm going to definitely want to hear your response to what David Cicilline said. We are talking about Amazon Web Services in Episode 4. Of our series, Amazon, The Prime Effect. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair. A new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today it's episode 4 of our series, Amazon, The Prime Effect, and we're looking at Amazon Web Services, or AWS, the $50 billion a year business that Amazon has that provides cloud computing services to huge companies like Netflix, we've talked about, Zoom, Slack, and thousands of others, both big and small. So you're probably touching or using AWS every day if you use the internet, and you don't even know it. So we're trying to learn the significance of that, the significance of the small number of companies that basically run the rapidly growing cloud computing market, and whether or not AWS is a good example of why federal regulators are taking a look at Amazon and saying, is it time to break it up? Break off things like Amazon Web Services. I'm joined today by Tim Bray. From December 2014 to May 2020, he was senior principal technologist and then VP at Amazon Web Services. He's with us from Vancouver, British Columbia. And I'd like now to introduce into the conversation Michael Cusimano. He is a distinguished professor of management and deputy dean at the MIT Sloan School of Management, author of 14 books, including his latest, The Business of Platforms, Strategy in the Age of Digital Competition, Innovation, and Power. Professor Cusimano, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. Happy to be here.
So it's great to have you. I'm going to ask both of you the same question here. And Tim, since you were listening patiently to Congressman Cicilline, I'll begin actually with you. You heard his definition of a modern-day monopoly, right? Cicilline said it was companies that use power to keep others out of the marketplace, preference their own goods and services, disadvantage consumers, crush small businesses, all of which result, he says, in a decline in innovation. Now, you worked inside Amazon, Tim. Do you think the company qualifies as a monopoly under those definitions?
Well, I'm a huge, excuse me, I'm a huge fan of Representative Cicilline and of his committee, which is a super high energy place with, you know, smart people from across the spectrum on it. And, you know, I guess I would say that, and I'm sure he would agree, is that, you know, just listening to him, you could become convinced that it's just a high tech problem. It's really much bigger than that. There are vast sectors of the global economy that are just egregiously monopolized. I would mention eyeglasses, mattresses, internet services, high bandwidth internet service provision. It just goes on and on and on. So I think he's absolutely right that monopolization is a pathology that's infecting the global marketplace. And I also think he's right that aggressive antitrust action to break up the big players in big tech, for sure, like Amazon and Google and Microsoft, is a fine idea. But I take it further than that, and I assume he and his band of merry people will go ahead and do that.
Okay, so Professor Cusimano, your take on this? I mean, are we in a different place regarding that small handful of big tech companies than we were, in the 90s and early 2000s with Microsoft and Windows and Internet Explorer when the Justice Department went after Microsoft?
Well, I'm not sure we're really in a different place. There may be more concentration now, but this has been a story going back more than 100 years. We had the same kind of complaints about railroads, about petroleum, Standard mm-hmm. Oil. So you're going to find some concentration. And there's nothing illegal about having a large or dominant market share. What is illegal is abusing a position in one market, tying it to others, preventing competitors overpricing to customers, or preventing competitors from dealing with customers. So it's not as straightforward. I would be very cautious about breaking up Amazon, but I do have certainly some thoughts about where they do seem to be potentially abusing their position. I'm not so sure about AWS, though.
Okay. So since you said that, give me some of those thoughts about the potential areas of abuse.
Well, there's been a lot of complaints over the years about the Amazon store and Amazon Marketplace. So these are two separate businesses. You talked about them before, using data from the marketplace to inform which products or services Amazon should go into directly, or what we call self-preferencing, giving their own products a first listing after a search. Many people use Amazon to search. So those kinds of practices do seem to be abusing its position. But that's different from Amazon Web Services. Amazon Web Services is really allowing third parties or outside companies to utilize the massive infrastructure and tools and technologies that Amazon built for its own digital platforms. And there's a lot of benefits to allowing that. I don't see evidence yet that they've been stealing customer data. I mean, the basic position is that customers own their own data on Amazon Web Services. So I think we need to know more if they really are violating those covenants of promising that customers own their own data, then yes, they are violating a rule. You can handle that through regulations.
Okay, so Tim Bray, you worked inside Amazon, inside AWS for 6 years here. And as you heard when I was talking to Congressman Cicilline, Amazon corporate PR states unequivocally that there's no data mining going on in AWS. Give us your take on that, since you were there writing the very code.
Well, right. I agree with in this particular case with what Amazon says and what with Professor just said, that I do really don't think that Amazon AWS is peeking into the customer's data that is being hosted by AWS, and I think it would be fatal to their business model if they did. But having said that, I still think they should break it up, if only for purely financial reasons, because of the fact that AWS is a very high margin business. It's getting $50 billion a year at 30% net margin. We'll do the arithmetic. That's $15 billion a year of free cash that's hurtling off of that. And that allows Amazon to go and invade other markets without having to worry about making
much money because they're cross-subsidizing it with money that's coming off AWS. And that's one of the core antitrust arguments. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure if there's actually any laws against doing that. But if there isn't, there probably should be, to, you know, Cicilline's point about needing new legislation. But that's the pain point I see.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. And Professor Cusimano, I'll turn back to you on that, because, you know, one of the things that Amazon has done in the past is use that massive amount, the influx of cash from AWS, to, in fact, grow some of its own businesses that actually do seem that are getting extreme scrutiny from regulators, as you heard. I'm thinking mainly of Amazon Marketplace, right? Some of the money from AWS helped Amazon Marketplace grow to, I think, the biggest business now that Amazon has now. Now, before I ask you a question, I do want to say that we asked this of Amazon corporate PR, and they say that right now Amazon's consumer division makes more than enough operating profit to fund its own operations and growth. That's true now, but AWS was the biggest profit center for Amazon for quite some time until Marketplace superseded it. But Professor Cusimano, respond to what Tim Bray is saying. Is that one of the things that allows it to behave monopolistically?
Well, again, I'm uncomfortable with the word monopolistically. Okay. But so Amazon is we called it a digital conglomerate in our book. It's really not so different from other businesses over the past century or more, like General Electric and others, who you take money from one business, you may invest it in another. We also wrote, though, about a concern. So, for example, Amazon uses the profits of AWS to buy Whole Foods and go whole scale into the grocery business, making life very difficult for a lot of grocery stores, for example. So that's, you know, that's kind of worrisome. If they bring lower prices, it's hard to charge them with monopolistic behavior. But if eventually they're the only player in town, or for online groceries, it's a problem. So there's definitely things we need to worry about. But a conglomerate or a company of multiple businesses, it does use funds to from one business to fund another. It's a standard practice, and Amazon does it. So it is true, until the last few years, the whole retail business of Amazon basically lost money, especially overseas. Retail is not a high-margin business. AWS is. So, you know, I agree with Tim. If Amazon did spin it out, AWS would be worth a fortune. Right now, the rest of Amazon is a drag on the financials of AWS. But I think that's really up to Amazon whether or not to split them apart, unless they really are abusing the position of AWS and harming competitors in some way.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more from Werner Vogels, Amazon's chief technology officer, because this question of breakup and AWS is one that I asked him, and here's what I said. As you well know, at the federal level, there's a lot of scrutiny going on about Amazon. Mm-hmm. And in fact, AWS seems to be a particular potential target for federal regulators who suggest that it should be actually broken out from Amazon as a whole. So do you think that AWS, given the revenues that it generates and how you described earlier how some of that feeds back into Amazon as a whole, that the AWS has a form of monopolistic power because of what it's able to do?
Well, if I think about this question of spin-off has been raised a number of times now. But I think if you look at reasons why companies actually spin off subsidiaries, it's either because they want to get that company off the financial statements, because it's not doing too great, or they just can't afford not fund a new business the way these subsidiaries need to be funded. That's in general, I think, the most reasons why these spin-offs happen. And I think at AWS, neither of these are true. Yeah, and so we have absolutely no plans to spin off the AWS business. Yeah, and I think our customers definitely don't want this distraction to happen. They're happy with how we are serving them. And so our customers want more capabilities. I mean, we delivered well over 2,000 new features and services last year. Customers want us to speed that up. They have an incredible hunger for having more and more of their IT problems solved by us. Our customers are not worried about this, or they're more worried that it may happen and that it will distract us from serving them.
That's Werner Vogels, Amazon's chief technology officer. You know, it absolutely is fascinating to me to discuss sort of the internal specifics of what AWS does and doesn't allow Amazon as a whole to do. But I actually think, and Tim, I'll give you credit for this, that I'm missing the bigger picture here, and I want to refocus on that. And that is the importance of the internet, the growing importance of cloud computing. We talked about how in the past, a century ago, some companies might have had VPs for electricity, but they don't anymore because electricity is considered, you know, a public good. It is a utility and therefore differently regulated as well. So, Tim, is it time to look at cloud computing as a utility?
That's a complicated question, and I think we're going to be discussing that because the idea is not crazy at all. But that is a radically new idea. You know, if we step outside Amazon for a second, some people have suggested that internet search should be made into a public utility because it's very worrying the way that Google and Facebook have basically monopolized all the revenue coming off of internet search and use that to, you know, grow lots of other businesses. And so there are certain individual cloud services that might function best as public utilities. But that's a long way from here. And I think the first step is to break them up. Sorry, Werner. But because, you know, he talked about the reasons you might spin off a subsidiary. He left out because the government made you, which, you know, is a popular one. And you know, the arguments he was offering there with respect to Werner, who's a smart guy, are the same ones we've heard from every monopolist throughout history when they've had that gun pointed at their heads. And they're just not very convincing. Our customers don't want us to be broken up. Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Professor Kusumano, your response to this question about maybe we need to be looking at cloud computing services through a completely different lens.
Well, we've also seen cloud computing evolving into being like an operating system. And so it's more than even just a utility. It's a development environment. So we do have competition among Amazon and Microsoft and Google and others to build new applications. And all the capabilities that Amazon can fold into its own services, artificial intelligence or blockchain or payment, these are available as functions to outside companies. So there is competition there. Amazon is doing really well, but Microsoft has a little bit of an edge in enterprise computing because of all its products. Amazon also has some advantages in that it's a neutral player. It's not trying to sell software products like Office. So again, it's more than just an electricity. It's also become a platform for innovation. So again, we have to be careful what we do with it.
Yeah. So just quickly, Microsoft has come up a couple of times. I mean, what can we learn about how Microsoft behaved after being threatened with breakup from the government?
So Microsoft was absolutely affected by the antitrust trial. So the outcome of the case was that Microsoft should be broken up into an operating system and an applications company. They appealed, they won on appeal, and then they had to proceed for a number of years under monitoring by a special master. But they definitely became much less aggressive, much less inclined to abuse their Windows position. So most of the activity we see in antitrust and the thrashing of teeth and all of that, it's really around the internet players and social media. So attention has shifted to Google and to some extent Apple, Facebook, and their acquisitions. So Microsoft got off easy in some ways, but it more or less focused on what it was good at its core business, enterprise computing. And now it's finally there in a big way in the cloud. It really missed mobile. Made some desperate acquisitions there like Nokia. But its behavior definitely became muted. And that probably will happen to Amazon as well.
Well, Michael Cusimano is deputy dean at the MIT Sloan School of Management and author of The Business of Platforms. Professor Cusimano, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tim Bray, we've got 30 seconds left, and it's time for you to tell us, I'm sorry if I have to make it brief, but why you left Amazon in May 2020.
Oh, it wasn't an AWS problem. It was the debate that was going on about whether good enough care was being taken care of the warehouse workers in the face of COVID. And Amazon said they were doing a huge amount of work on it, and the warehouse workers said they were still scared, and I believe both sides. And then Amazon went and fired the activists who were speaking up on behalf of the warehouse workers. And, you know, as a VP, I couldn't go rogue publicly, so I felt I had to leave.
So you left in protest of how they were treating the warehouse workers?
No, I left in protest about firing the activists who were speaking up on behalf of the warehouse workers.
Okay. Well, you know what? We're going to be talking about labor at Amazon in a future episode of our series, The Prime Effect. So Tim Bray, though, it's been great to have you today. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been fun.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.